Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, NFL football edition. We are back in the saddle after a one-week hiatus. I'm your host, Todd Furman, joined, as always, by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only, Payne Insider. And Payne, I know we let a lot of our listeners down last week. They felt lost trying to navigate through the National Football League landscape.
I'm trying to figure out how that could be. I understand we weren't here, but, and I love that we're a part of your weekly rotation. I think no less than 10 times we mentioned we were going to have an off week to celebrate your pending nuptials. And then the college football podcast, we mentioned it there at the top. The Monday Night Football podcast last week, we mentioned it there. The emails are very interesting to me that came across.
We may have to do a mailbag around these parts then. Yeah. I may have to poke around, read some of those emails, and see exactly the kind of feedback that was there. But it just speaks.
I try to keep my off seasons clean, but there would be some fun emails to divulge there on a podcast.
Yeah, we did share last Monday, but I know sometimes the Monday podcast doesn't get quite the same listenership as we do on Thursday, especially when we're not offering up any investment advice there. But we are back, looking forward to what should be a great second half of the season of sorts. A little bit of a weird board this weekend. I'm not sure weird is the right adjective to use to describe it. We're going to do our best to try and make heads or tails of some of the marquee matchups, two primetime games that leave a lot to be desired, and two games on the Sunday slate that'll have potentially big ramifications in their respective conferences. So let's kick things off.
Way to sell it, Todd.
I'm not a salesman. I've never been a salesman. I've never been in that realm. So I'm trying to preface it and set expectations low, because around here, we like to underpromise and overdeliver, and that's exactly what we are going to do on this show, much like the Arizona Cardinals have done all season long. Although they've underpromised and underdelivered, they still find themselves 2.5-point home favorites as they'll welcome in the New Orleans Saints on Thursday Night Football. Total in this game sits at 43. We do see it down a bit from a consensus opener of 45. And when you look at some of the quarterbacks potentially going tonight, Andy Dalton, second worst straight-up primetime record since 2000, 6-18. He's lost 11 straight road primetime games, longest streak by any quarterback since 1970, Payne. Andy Dalton has lost 5 straight primetime games by 17-plus points, longest streak by any quarterback, like we said, since 1970, and a robust 9-15 against the spread number. Now, his counterpart, Kyler Murray, 0-4 straight-up, 0-4 against the spread, last 4 primetime starts. Passing touchdowns, interceptions, passer rating, nothing to write home about. But it is Dennis Allen, who's lost 13 straight games as an underdog dating back to 2013 when he was with the Raiders. So many compelling angles to try and attack, especially trying to figure out what these respective offenses will look like without some familiar faces in the fold and one big name making his season debut for the Cardinals.
I think what's always interesting about some of these games, the crappier they are, the further you dig in the wormhole. And it makes some of these games a little bit more interesting. Obviously, betting is going to help viewership in a game like this. Now, relative to what we've seen the last couple Thursdays, from a namesake perspective, this is an upgrade.
There's some star power out there.
Yeah, I'm oddly looking forward to it. So, you know, let's start with the Saints offense. All signs are pointing to Andy Dalton being under center, and quietly, no one's talked about it, but there appears to be a quarterback controversy in New Orleans because Jameis is suited up back-to-back weeks now. I think they like a lower variance style of play, which doesn't shock you with Dennis Allen being a defensive coordinator. That's what we're seeing, right? Dalton's a little bit more calculated. Jameis certainly higher variance. To this point, the Saints offense has been really good running the football. Kamara looks healthy. Ingram appears to have some juice left in the tank, and then we've seen a sprinkle of Taysom Hill now that he's a little healthy here. And all told, you're looking at a Saints offense second in schedule-adjusted rush efficiency. The offensive line's getting some push despite some guys being in and out of the lineup. They're eighth in yards before first contact, so that's a positive. New Orleans, I think, has to be able to run it tonight. Get out, build the early lead. We know the Cardinals have scored 3 first quarter points all season. They've played with the lead at the lowest rate in the league. So if you can keep the ground game in the mix and not completely have to rely on Dalton, who's certainly not 100% here, and we know the receiving core is banged up with Michael Thomas and Landry and Troutman still out, I think you have to be able to be in a game state where you can rely on your run game. Now, what's interesting here is quietly the Cardinals defense is playing much better the last month, and no one's talking about it because Arizona isn't winning and the offense is a disaster with Cliff and Kyler, and that's far more exciting to talk about. But the defensive improvement has gone pretty much untalked about here. Arizona has stopped the run quite well over the last 4 games. They're 3rd best in EPA allowed per rush the first 3 quarters since week 3. Cardinals are getting, you know, as I alluded to, healthier a little bit on defense, specifically in the secondary. Now, it's interesting, obviously, you get Olave back. I think that's a huge help for the Saints offense, not just because he appears to be an extremely viable weapon, but his ability to stretch the field opens things up for the ground game, right? He creates that space. The other guy to look at tonight a little bit is Juwan Johnson. I mentioned Troutman being down. So Juwan Johnson goes to being the primary tight end target. And he's a guy that has some traits that are really interesting, right? He's like 6'4", 235. He runs 4'5". Arizona's defense has been the most sensitive to tight end passes in the league by a mile. Teams are targeting Cardinals tight ends at a 28% of dropbacks, the highest rate in the league. And it's because the Cardinals are dead last in receptions and yards allowed to the tight end position. Arizona's dead last in EPA defending tight end passes. And it's really a byproduct of what we discussed in our offseason preview, right? Like Simmons and Collins to this point are not just liabilities, but absolute zeros. If you look at Isaiah Simmons and Zayvon Collins.
Tell us how you really feel, Payne. Tell us how you really feel about the last 2 linebackers the Cardinals have drafted.
I'm not saying anything new, though.
No.
Right? I mean, we talked about those issues last season. We talked about the issues again in the preview. And we kind of alluded to why that was happening, right? The green dot is a linebacker position, right? That's typically where Arizona went with a safety to be their green dot. And the guys they brought on from a veteran standpoint just hinted that they weren't completely comfortable with Simmons and Zayvon Collins. And right now, their linebackers number 48 and 69 out of 86 qualifying linebackers in coverage. You also have to worry about Kamara now. As I mentioned, he looks a little healthy. And then it's not just in the ground game. 12 receptions out of the backfield the last 2 weeks for a tick below 10 yards a catch. So I think you're going to see, at least when the Saints do pass, it'd be smart to put those, to put the two Utes in conflict through the air.
Hey, I mean, do everything you can with a little bit of eye candy. Confuse them. Try and throw a couple of interesting wrinkles at them on a short week. I know it's hard to institute a brand new game plan, but to your point, it wasn't the Saints' offense that let them down last weekend when they lost 30-26 against the Bengals. It was some of their defensive frailty, and unfortunately for them, Marshawn Lattimore appears to be down again. They will get some reinforcements in the secondary with the return of Marcus May, but when you look at this Arizona offense, I mean, you highlighted some of their struggles. Horrifically slow starts. They did finally show a little bit in the second half against the Philadelphia Eagles in their last home game, but this has really been a house of horrors. And if Cliff Kingsbury is supposed to be the offensive mind, granted he gets DeAndre Hopkins back, and the numbers don't lie in terms of Kyler Murray's performance with Hopkins in the lineup versus without Hopkins in the mix. What do you anticipate Arizona doing to try and attack a Saints defense that has been extremely vulnerable over the last couple of weeks?
I think this is really a good conversation because it just aligns with the Cardinals, because, you know, granted there's some wonkiness going on in the NFL with offenses through the first 6 weeks. Just kind of forget that for a minute. Generally speaking, the last handful of years, we've seen this push towards more passing because it's more efficient. And I think because of that, people just equate spread offenses that like to throw as being, you know, modern and new school and innovative and hyper efficient. Let me tell you, you can be directionally right, but absolute dog shit. And that's ultimately what's going on with the Cardinals offense, right? And we said it last year, despite the 7-0 start, we kept banging the table and telling you Cliff Kingsbury isn't that guy. And you would be amazed by those emails as well that we got across from Arizona fans. And I got to tell you, it's been whisper quiet since.
Not a whole lot to celebrate out here in the desert.
Yeah, like you're just looking at a guy, like the offense isn't very creative. One play doesn't set up the next all that often. Defenses have made adjustments and Cliff hasn't countered the counter. And the little things that we talk about all the time, like pre-snap motion and play action, Arizona doesn't do it. 32nd in pre-snap motion rate. Kyler throws with play action just 17% of the time. That's 31st out of 37 qualifying quarterbacks. And it's led to 3 points in the first quarter this season. And that immediately tells you the script and the game plan aren't good enough from Cliff. And it's not like Arizona's faced a daunting schedule of defenses here, right? I mean, in the first half through six games, Arizona's 27th in both success rate and EPA per play, and that's against the 22nd toughest schedule of defenses. So there's a real problem here, and I think the two areas that we emphasized this offseason that were clear regression candidates were third downs and offensive line play. Arizona had the highest rate of third down efficiency over expectation last season, and their offensive line was old and inconsistent. And right now, Arizona's 26th in late down efficiency, and tonight, two of their three best offensive linemen and starting center, Rodney Hudson and guard Justin Pugh, are both out because they're a little older. And I just think this is wild to watch. You paid Kyler all this money. You were kind of forced to, but you just kind of watch him play out there and his mannerisms and his body language. It's very tough to watch. It's clear him and Cliff are not on the same page. There's been some whispers that Cliff is kind of over the situation, wouldn't mind heading back to college and not dealing with this. And you might see a little bit of that in the game plans, right? Because suddenly now the script and the game plans aren't very good. But I think the other thing here is, like, we have to stop putting it all on Cliff. Kyler's been horrific, right? Accuracy is atrocious. He's dead last in EPA on throws of 10 plus yards downfield. He kind of just lives in the basement of multiple key metrics. And the other thing here is, under pressure, Kyler's averaging 2.7 yards per pass attempt for a mobile quarterback. That's pretty laughable. Tonight, that needs to change, because this will surprise some people. And you mentioned at the top, the liability for the Saints has been defensively the last few weeks. And we kind of saw it in the underlying metrics early on in the season. And we just thought, hey, you know, it's playing this quirky Atlanta offense that nobody knew what to expect week one. But the Saints are dead last in pressure rate. That's shocking for a team with Cam Jordan. And the Saints blitz at the fourth lowest rate. Marshawn Lattimore is out, as you mentioned. Let's keep an eye on Paulson Adebo. He's questionable. The Saints' defense is a little bit beat up in the secondary, although they do get Marcus May back, as you alluded to. This is the week, though, the Cardinals' passing game has to make some improvements, because you're looking at a back that's been shredded, you know, the last 2 weeks through the air. Geno and Burrow, 53% passing success rate the last 2 weeks against this Saints defense. And I think the one guy you mentioned, which is interesting, is Hopkins returning. I think we've outlined that ad nauseum 4, 5, 10 times on how important D-Hop is to Kyler. Last year alone, when Hopkins was on the field, Murray's completion percentage increased 7%. His yards per pass attempt increased by 2.2 yards. The problem is, Hopkins' return was supposed to boost what was already taking shape with Hollywood Brown. And so with Hollywood Brown down, does the Cardinals passing offense truly get the boost we thought was coming with Hopkins? And, you know, right now we're basically just exchanging receivers and you're getting the older guy that isn't as much of a downfield threat. The one glimmer of hope that you had for the Cardinals offense was shockingly Hollywood Brown. The guy was averaging 3.3 yards of separation per route run. He's also third in the league, accounting for 42% of the Cardinals' air yards. This is a spot where Kyler and Cliff just need to show up. And I'll be honest, and it goes back to what we talked about at the top with Cliff. He hasn't thrived in these situations. He has been very poor with game plans, scripts, and schemes. So it doesn't shock you that he's 0-4 straight up and against the spread in these short week games, three of which the Cardinals were pretty large favorites, Todd.
Yeah, I'm not sure which of these two head coaches, to be quite honest, I trust on a short week to be innovative, to try and right some of the wrongs. And obviously the Saints dealing with a few more injuries on both the offensive and defensive side of the ball. But to your point, I mean, Arizona had a lot of optimism that this passing attack could hit stride if you had a healthy Hollywood Brown opposite DeAndre Hopkins, potentially giving a boost to the guys like Zach Ertz, Rondale Moore, and A.J. Green, who more often than not has been on a milk carton. So we'll see exactly what Arizona is able to put out there. What was interesting is Cliff Kingsbury wasn't quite sure the kind of workload that they could put on Hopkins. Hopkins, short week of practice that he came back to get things ramped up to full speed. Hopkins says he'll be a full go, but it will be interesting to keep tabs on a guy who's typically out there for 100% of the snap share offensively, at least when he's operating at peak performance. From Thursday to Sunday we go, and a massive showdown in the AFC South and a rematch of sorts between the Indianapolis Colts and the Tennessee Titans. Right now across the board, you're looking at the Tennessee Titans, a 2.5-point favorite. Total on the game sits at 42.5. This game has been bet off of the key number of 3. We saw sharp money come in on the dog earlier this week. The Titans, winners of 4 straight meetings versus the Colts, their longest win streak in series history. That being said, the Colts have had a lot of success in Nashville, as home field advantage hasn't dictated the team that typically walks away victorious. When you look back at the first matchup just a few short weeks ago, the Titans defeated the Colts 24-17, winning outright as a 4-point underdog. The biggest issue for the Colts, they turned it over 3 times, finished the game -3, and were ill-equipped to slow down Derrick Henry in any capacity. Meanwhile, on the other side, Jonathan Taylor completely bottled up, 2.1 yards per carry, 42 yards total on 20 rushes. Now, I present all of that in a couple interesting notes here. When you look at the Titans in the regular season with Mike Vrabel having extra rest, 8-0 straight up and against the spread, but Indianapolis has been dynamic where it matters at the betting window as an underdog, 2-0 straight up in that role this season, 6-2 straight up, 7-1 against the number the last 8 times they've caught points. And when we talk about Frank Reich, we highlighted on the preseason preview, Indianapolis could take time to gel. The numbers support it. They struggle the first month of the season, but they are 30-16 week 6 or later under Frank Reich. And you started to see the offense look a little bit different last week against the Jacksonville Jaguars. Matt Ryan chucked it around the yard 58 times, partially by necessity, being down Jonathan Taylor and Nyheim Hines. But most importantly for me, Payne, he was not sacked a single time. Let's see if they're aggressive enough to attack the Titans secondary, where we know they're extremely vulnerable.
Yeah, I think the other thing that, you know, you have to account for just a little bit, because that was an interesting trend, because we do think Vrabel, at least schematically, is a very good coach. But yes, Indianapolis played last week, but they kind of had their mini bye the week prior. So we're talking about, you know, playing 2 games since the 6th. So I don't know if, like, that's going to be a massive factor in this one. Now, you mentioned the conversation we had a little bit here before the Broncos game on that Thursday night. And I think we kind of outlined the Colts, the struggles they were having offensively and how it would take some time and how they were dead last in offensive efficiency at that point. And we said, you know, check back around week 10, 11 to see if there's been any improvement. We're obviously not there yet as we head into week 7, but there were some signs last week of marginal improvement. I still think there's a ton of unknowns. You know, you look at how Indy's approached their offensive game plans the last 2 weeks, and it's been a lot of chucking. Last week, they went no huddle at a wildly high rate. Matt Ryan dropping back to throw 99 times the last 2 games. Is that who they want to be? Or to your point, is it out of necessity? Is it a byproduct of both Jonathan Taylor and Nyheim Hines being down? And I think there's probably a combination of both, but I think that creates some variance, especially in regards to the total, and it's why you've seen this battle going on all week where, you know, one group comes in and goes over 41 on the bye, sending it to 43.5, and then once it gets there, another respected group comes in and hits the under, and it's why we're kind of settled in at this 42.5 mark, because if you're using full season priors, then you're going to say, hey, you know, the number might be a touch high, but if you're kind of waiting the last couple games where the Colts have been super pass heavy, you can make the case for the over. So it'll be interesting to see who ultimately wins that battle. Now, last week, with the uptick in passing with Matt Ryan, you're seeing a different approach, right, of kind of getting it out of his hands quicker. Ryan had the 8th fastest release time. Now, the Colts had some positive variance on third down. They went 10 of 15. But again, it was still an improvement overall offensively. I think, you know, when we talk about this variance, the question becomes, it looks like Jonathan Taylor and Hines are both trending in the right direction. Do we see a revert to the run game, or does Reich keep up these high pass rates? It sounds wild not feeding Jonathan Taylor, right? But the Titans are number one in EPA per rush allowed on early downs the first three quarters this season. Teams have a 20% rushing success rate under the same parameters against Tennessee. But through the air, Tennessee is an absolute sieve. 28th in EPA per dropback the first three quarters on early downs, 29th in adjusted pass efficiency. If you remove turnovers, Tennessee is dead last in EPA against the pass. So if Frank Reich comes out with the right game plan, they should have success against Tennessee's defense. Also have to keep an eye on the injury report. Looks like Bud Dupree is going to be a go for Tennessee. That's a good get back. Amani Hooker was a full go on Wednesday as well for the Titans. Zach Cunningham, though, their leader in the middle of the defense, has not practiced yet this week.
Yeah, and you mentioned this Colts passing attack. Part of it obviously comes as Matt Ryan continues to get on the same page with his receivers. Michael Pittman, a career high last week, 13 catches on 16 targets for 134 yards. You saw Alec Pierce start to flash a little bit. He, of course, had the game-winning touchdown.
Oh, I saw him flash very late.
Yeah, trust me, I would have been much more content settling for a field goal for contest purposes, but I don't want to digress or get my blood pressure up first thing on a Thursday morning. And more importantly, a man that you've talked about over the last couple seasons actually went out there and produced in Paris Campbell, 7 for 57 and a touchdown. So if the Colts can get their weapons involved, and to your point, they get Nyheim Hines back, who is significantly more dynamic as a receiver than Deion Jackson, it gives them a little bit more versatility than what we've seen. Now, on the other side, the Titans have had extra time to prepare for this matchup. And when you look at Tennessee offensively, it's been a lot of smoke and mirrors. I mean, this is a team mired in mediocrity, and that may be too much praise when you look at their yards per play metrics. Weren't able to go over 250 total yards offensively in wins against the Colts a couple weeks ago, or even going into the bye against the Commanders. Had to withstand a last-minute push from Carson Wentz and company. Now, to their credit, Derrick Henry, three straight games, 130-plus scrimmage yards, have resulted in all Titans victories, did have 30 touches. Can Indianapolis try and find a way to solidify their run defense, which was their Achilles heel the first time against Tennessee, and then, quite frankly, Payne, wasn't a hell of a lot better last week against the Jacksonville Jaguars?
I think that's what makes this side of the matchup so interesting, because you have a defensive coordinator for the Colts and Gus Bradley, who's, I'll just be honest, not my vibe, okay? But the Titans offense hasn't proven it can do a thing once the script wears off and the game plan goes stale. More than 85% of the Titans points have been scored in the first half. That's most in the league. Tennessee's scored 0 fourth quarter points this season. And what's interesting and specific to your question is the Colts were stopping the run the first 3 weeks. I mean, they were stopping it well. The last 3 weeks, though, Indy has been gashed on the ground, 29th in EPA per rush allowed, 30th in rushing success rate allowed over those last three games as well. It does look like the Colts will have Shaq Leonard back in the middle of their defense. He is their team leader. I know he's not some thumper, but he just seems to help get them lined up and in the right spots. I do think this side of the ball comes down to scheme. Totally, right? We talk all the time about talent mattering, and it does, but this is very much scheme-driven on this side. What is Gus Bradley going to do here after seeing the Titans' offense in week four, to your point, have some success? And generally speaking, based on the defensive style that Gus Bradley typically employs, running and play action work well against it. And that's the entire basis of the Titans' identity, you know? And we saw that last week, to your point, against Jacksonville. The Jags were number one in EPA per rush last week against Indy. More than 61% of runs were successful. And then what happened off that? Trevor Lawrence threw with play action on more than 32% of dropbacks, and he churned out an 88% adjusted accuracy, 9.4 yards per pass attempt, and a 145 passer rating with play action. So that is the Titans formula: run, throw with play action. Back in week four, again, the Titans were efficient on the ground, 48% success rate against the Colts. The hope is, though, that Gus Bradley makes some adjustments. And the saving grace here is this: the Titans O-line hasn't been anything to write home about. You know, let's keep an eye on Nate Davis. Looks like he is questionable for this game, but from a predictive measure, the Titans are 31st in yards per rush before first contact. Jacksonville was number one. So a drop down in class, and hopefully a better idea on how to stop the Titans offense a little bit after having seen it a couple weeks ago. And somehow, if the Colts can stop that early script, I think they set themselves up well here.
Such an interesting game, because obviously everybody couldn't get enough of the Indianapolis Colts. We saw how their division futures moved during the summer months to before the season, where they went from right around plus $1.15, depending on the book, upwards of $1.40 or $1.50. And then in the wake of a tie against the Houston Texans and some pretty lethargic performances out of the gates before they got into the win column against Kansas City, people were ready to fully eulogize them. And here we are now with a chance to take control of the division, even up the season series if things break the right way against a rested Tennessee Titans side. From the early time slot pain to the late afternoon and arguably the best game of the entire weekend, a Super Bowl revenge matchup of sorts. We'll see Kansas City hit the highway, headed to the Bay Area to take on the San Francisco 49ers. And right now you're looking at Kansas City, a 2.5-point road favorite. Total in this game, 48.5. The dog has taken money as the threes have disappeared, and you've also seen the over tick up from as low as 46.5, 47, depending on the book. This will be the first meeting since they met in the Super Bowl a few years ago back in Miami. Obviously, that was the postseason where the Chiefs became cardiac kids. Patrick Mahomes became the youngest quarterback to win MVP. And who knows how differently things would have gone if Tyreek Hill doesn't convert a 3rd-and-11. And Jimmy Garoppolo doesn't miss Emmanuel Sanders streaking down the middle of the field. When you look at strength on strength, I know there's some noise in the numbers. Clearly the matchup
last two sentences need to be included?
Yeah, of course I had to put them out there. I know how you feel about that. I'm allowed to take shots here, whether they're veiled or not. If it's a first-time listener or long-time listener, they'll begin to figure out where I'm coming from on all of this. When you look at this matchup, for me, I think the most fascinating one that we're going to want to watch is Patrick Mahomes in this high-powered Chiefs offense, who is exceeding expectations from an EPA standpoint, given some of the narrative out there, against a 49ers defense that's not going to be at full strength, but could get a couple of key reinforcements back that weren't available last weekend in Atlanta.
So, you're kind of leading us down the path where I think we start with the 49ers offense here. And there's so many reasons why, and I'd like to divulge, but can't completely divulge. There's just this season's been extremely weird and wonky, and there's been, you know, a ton of variants, a ton of weird things happening. And you know, I think we've kind of figured out internally why some of these things are happening. But you know, specific to this side of the ball with the 49ers offense going against the Chiefs defense, this is a check the injury report type of handicap. And ultimately, this side of the ball has some really, really important ones. And you know, the Chiefs secondary right now has some issues, right? They're 28th in schedule adjusted pass efficiency. Offenses know this. They're attacking the Chiefs through the air. The Chiefs are facing about 41 pass attempts per game. That's the most in the league. Starting corner Trent McDuffie has not played since week one with a hamstring. He's trending in a positive direction. Starting corner Rashad Fenton hasn't practiced this week. Keep an eye there. Defensive end Mike Dana is dealing with a calf injury. He's played some limited snaps. Willie Gay should return after his 4-game suspension. So these are some key cogs in that defensive side of the ball. We saw Buffalo have some success, at least visually, attacking rookie sixth rounders, undrafted guys from the practice squad last week through the air. But again, the perception of what transpired last week is a little interesting again. You know, I mean, right before the half, Buffalo's backed up on their 2-yard line with a 3rd-and-13 situation. They somehow turned that drive into points. You have a situation where the Chiefs are leading. You have a nice pass to Travis Kelce that sets you up with 1st-and-goal inside the 10. And, you know, they call offensive pass interference. If you look last week to kind of your hint at the top, the Chiefs were 3rd-best in EPA per play last week. Buffalo was 12th. They played each other, and obviously Buffalo won the game on the scoreboard. But what's interesting here, partly to your hinting at some guys coming back from injury, let's, again, keep your eyes peeled to Trent Williams. He is an all-world left tackle, practice in a limited fashion on Wednesday. We've kind of insinuated at how tough that dude is. We saw him play through an ankle injury all last postseason. This was a high ankle sprain that was supposed to take 6 weeks. We told you probably would not, just based upon the human that it happened to. That would be a huge get back, because it looks like Mike McGlinchey, the starting right tackle for San Francisco, is a long shot to play from what we're hearing. So if you get a situation where Trent McDuffie, Fenton, and Dana are all down for KC, and Trent Williams is back, and, you know, again, I don't think McClinchy is, but if somehow he were to play in this one, you have to make some manual adjustments on this side of the ball. Now, the same thing is true if the inverse happens, right, where if Casey gets a bunch of those guys back and somehow Trent Williams isn't quite ready. The other thing that's interesting here is the Chiefs have struggled through the air defensively, mostly to these injuries. KC, though, started the season red hot stopping the run, but the last 2 weeks, they've been gashed. So that's something to kind of think about, the way KC's defense is trending on the ground. I think some of it has to do with, you know, protecting those young guys in the secondary and not allocating as many guys to the box, but that's, you know, not the 49ers' problem. And right now, the 49ers, even with some of those O-line injuries, they're fourth in yards per rush before first contact. So they're creating some holes there. And I think the interesting part here is, like, I believe we'll see a little bit more Debo this week because he wasn't really involved at the normal rate that he's typically is last week against Atlanta. And I think we see a tick up for him against the Chiefs. We know the cornerbacks are potentially injured. Receiver one options have absolutely feasted against Kansas City. And I think when we see Shanahan put Debo in the backfield, there's a way to get him the ball from those sets as a pass catcher, because the Chiefs have been horrific defending running back passes. So maybe implementing Debo out of the backfield as a pass catcher is a really interesting wrinkle here. The Chiefs have missed the fourth most tackles. They've graded out a bottom 10 tackling defense. So you could see a situation where you're getting Debo the ball and there's a real opportunity for some yak. You mentioned this total, Todd, and I'll just be candid. With some of these injuries, I can absolutely see why we've gone from the bottom of 46.5 through the key of 47 out to 48.5. My number just doesn't get me there. So it'll be interesting to see where this number goes from here. And again, I think it'll all be predicated on this injury report.
I mean, we saw it last week, the 49ers and Falcons giving the myriad of injuries to 49ers defensive starters. That total from 42 closed significantly higher. I want to say 45.5, 46, and looked like it was going to go flying over the total. And 28-14, game kind of dies. So able to beat the market there, but the game still comes under by more than a field goal.
Mentioned flew once, over in the advanced box score.
That's what I was going to say. If you dig into some of the stats, it should have flown over. I mean, it's not oftentimes that a team trailing by two touchdowns takes roughly an eight-minute drive when they're trying to get back in a football game that comes up short on down, starting in the shadow of their own end zone at the one-yard line, dying on the Falcons 19. When you look at the other side of the ball, tons of star power here. Patrick Mahomes, you dig into some of the numbers, though. A little bit, I don't want to say concerning because it's a short sample size in terms of what he's done as far as the fourth quarter is concerned. We know how good he is under pressure and the ways that he forces defenses to pay for their mistakes. The 49ers, though, could get a breath of fresh air on the defensive side. A player as impactful there to Trent Williams would be Nick Bosa, who practiced in a limited capacity earlier this week as well.
Yeah, you mentioned Mahomes, and, you know, prior to last week, he was playing at the same rate the season he won MVP. So it's amazing how a little fourth quarter variance changes the narrative on Patrick Mahomes.
Hey, and the 55 passer rating in the fourth quarter. So, I mean, I got to throw out the numbers there.
This is interesting because what you're seeing is defenses are throwing the kitchen sink at Reed and Mahomes.
Yep.
And you can kind of see the evolution of this, right? It used to be nothing but man coverage. Mahomes proved he could beat that. And then last season, it was tons of too high shell. Eventually, from about the middle point of the season through the start of the playoffs, Reed and Mahomes showed everyone they could beat that. And now what you're hearing from Reed and Mahomes in these pressers, they're saying that defenses are doing very little of what they're actually putting on film. So it's created this interesting dynamic where they're having to go back to things they created in the offseason to attack these defenses. And the one thing we're seeing is higher rates of man coverage because they're forcing this receiver group to consistently prove they can separate against man and win one-on-one. The other underlying thing here that I would think helps San Francisco a little bit is D'Amico Ryans. He is the 49ers defensive coordinator. He's become one of the best defensive minds over the last 12 to 18 months. Ryans played for Andy Reid in Philadelphia, so there's a lot of familiarity there with some of the things that Reid likes to do. Now, again with the injury report. The 49ers, I think, are going to be slightly healthier than last week, but they're still dealing with some injuries, right? Eric Armstead, Javon Kinlaw, Mosley are all out. That's three starters. Hufanga entered the concussion protocol on Tuesday after feeling the effects of a hit from Sunday, of which he cleared and went back in the game. So, I don't know what's going on with the new protocol. But
I don't think the NFL knows what's going on with the new protocol, so there's no shot that you or I have any understanding of how it's working.
Yeah, got back in the game and then woke up Tuesday morning. He's like, boy, I've got a headache. So he's now in the concussion protocol. I don't know if you can clear that if you get put in on Tuesday. I just don't know. Jimmy Ward wants to play. If he does, it'll be with a club on his hand. Chavarius Ward missed practice Wednesday with a groin injury. We've kind of seen what groin injuries do to cornerbacks. I mean, Xavien Howard's been limping through one for about 3 weeks now. He looks like a shell of himself. Obviously, Chavarius Ward, former Chief. Chiefs couldn't afford to pay him. He's going to want to play in this game. Let's see how effective he is. It does look like Nick Bosa is back. Jason Verrett will make his debut off IR. I mean, who knows what that looks like in game one. But the 49ers defense still has the potential to be without four or five defensive starters. And the difference this week versus last, Marcus Mariota only threw it 14 times. Atlanta wants to run the ball. The Chiefs are programmed to throw it. And you see that because 75% of the Chiefs' yards have come through the air this season. That's the highest rate in the NFL. But you go back to last week, those 14 passes from Mariota were wildly efficient. He finished number one in passing success rate, number two in EPA plus completion percentage above expectation of all the quarterbacks in week six. And you think about the quarterbacks the 49ers have faced this season. Mariota, Mayfield, Russ, Justin Fields, Geno, and a Rams offense that's decimated by injury and showing just a real lack of production. So this is a big step up in class for the 49ers defense. Now, even stepping up in class, along with some of these defensive injuries that we mentioned, there's two things San Francisco's defense has to do to survive here. The first is obvious, right? Get pressure. Brett Veach he's going to thank his lucky stars Orlando Brown declined his offer this past summer, because Orlando Brown is not a very good left tackle. In fact, he's graded out 60th in pass blocking among 77 qualifiers. Andrew Wiley is a backup guard in this league, starting at right tackle. He's graded out tackle 64 out of 77 in pass blocking. You're kind of going left field here. I like the idea of signing OBJ and potentially trading for a Burns or a Cam Jordan, but the cheap, easy move is for the Chiefs to trade for a right tackle and Taylor Moten. That's for another day, though. The 49ers defense is second in pressure rate. And D'Amico Ryans doesn't blitz at a ridiculously high rate to generate that pressure. So that's the first key. Get to Mahomes naturally. Get him off his spots. Be able to keep more guys in coverage knowing your secondary is banged up. The second key factor here is the 49ers linebackers. Of all the linebackers that have played at least 300 snaps this season, Dre Greenlaw is graded out third best in coverage, Fred Warner eighth. Those two guys have to stop Travis Kelce one-on-one when they're presented with that matchup. Kelce right now has seen 62% of his receptions go for a first down or a touchdown.
The guy's a beast. Father Time's got nothing on him.
Yeah. Good podcast, too, by the way, with him and his brother.
It was. By the way, that was interesting with his brother busting his chops about what the Kansas City Chiefs were going to do and why Travis helped free up some cap space, claiming that he had no knowledge of what Kansas City wanted to get done before the trade deadline.
Yeah, he just said to his agent, they're just going to pay me more money up front in a lump sum. And he was like, yep, that sounds good.
Exactly. I'm not going to ask any other questions. I'll take it.
Yep. So, you know, whether it's Greenlaw or Warner, they have to be able to defend Kelce one-on-one. And so far, you're looking at a 49ers defense that's sixth in receptions allowed and second in yards allowed to tight end. So those are the two key factors here for this 49ers defense to survive with some of its starters out. Got to get natural pressure so you don't have to allocate more guys to the blitz, right? You can kind of protect your beat-up secondary. And then being able to shut down Kelce one-on-one and not having to double him. So again, you can allocate another guy in the secondary and coverage. And that's the way the 49ers have the ability to survive the Chiefs offense here.
I'm going to ask you a question, and you can call me an idiot, a moron. You can use any term that you'd like here. Are you surprised?
Well, you do know the average of 18 and 26, so you started the day on fire.
That was a small victory. We take small victories and we can get them around these parts. When you look at the way the market has responded, are you surprised the move came as early as it did on the 49ers, or is that purely about the value of the three? Grab the three, figure out what to do with it later, because a favorable injury report, you're sitting pretty, and if not, you can easily lay a cheap money line or lay the Chiefs back at 2.5.
Yeah, I think we talk pretty frequently about asymmetric risk, and three is the largest key number in football. So there really wasn't a chance, I don't think, of this going to 3.5. And what you saw immediately was the move from 3 down to 2 was with Nick Bosa and Trent Williams returning to practice. And we talk about premium positions all the time. Left tackle, premium position. Pass rusher, premium position. And I think it's even more in a matchup like this when you see a Chiefs defense that's had trouble the last few weeks stopping the run, when you see a Chiefs offensive line that its tackle positions are having trouble negating pressures, and those two guys are just combined well worth more than half a point to the spread. Now, it's through the three, so that half point has substantially more value than its numerical number. But just to kind of give you that idea that those two guys are probably in totality worth, it's going to sound crazy to some people, but at least worth 2 points, both of them together.
No, makes a ton of sense. And that's why the markets move the way they do. Obviously, as we know in the National Football League, you keep tabs on the injury reports. Things can change at a moment's notice. The early bird gets the worm, and there is such a huge change in expected win probability for professional bettors to get the best of it and figure out what to do with some of those numbers later. You can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there as well. Most importantly, as always, follow the Bet the Board podcast. And you haven't already done so, I don't know what you're waiting for. Sign up and subscribe to the Bet the Board newsletter. Plenty of great content in there, reminders about all the things that we have going on across the Bet the Board family. And if you haven't tuned into our array of other podcasts, encourage you to do so. Stay Green, all about NASCAR. We have 3 races to go in the season, and a newly launched sports memorabilia and cards collectible show where Payne and a minority owner, Jesse Craig of PWCC, do an outstanding job breaking down a rapidly growing industry and an alternative investment asset class. Last but certainly not least, Payne, Sunday Night Football takes us down to South Florida, and it's the Brian Flores revenge game. The Miami Dolphins, 7-point.
You mean the Tua revenge game?
Yeah, that too. I read some of those comments. They were quite interesting. The Dolphins, a 7-point favorite. We'll call the total 44.5 on the consensus. Just the second home primetime game for the Miami Dolphins franchise over the last 5 years, the last one coming a season ago on Thursday Night Football, where they upset the Baltimore Ravens as more than a touchdown underdog. The Steelers' win versus the Bucs was their first without T.J. Watt since they drafted him. However, if you dig into the Steelers' number this season, they're not exactly pretty. The worst score differential, minus 49 through 6 games for the Silver and Black, going all the way back to 1989. And when you look at the Steelers, if they remain a 7-point underdog, this would be the second time since 1970 the Steelers are a 7-point dog in 3 straight games since the year 2000. Mitch Trubisky, last 3 primetime starts, all resulted in double-digit losses. We're going to monitor that quarterback situation as it continues to unfold. But when you look at Mike Tomlin, hey, we know this guy has exceeded oddsmakers' expectations as an underdog, but this roster clearly devoid of a lot of the key pieces that you need to stay in ball games. You mentioned the Tua revenge game. Tua expected to start for Miami, which should breathe a little bit of life into a Dolphins offense that's been mired in quicksand over the last 3 weeks. Started the season like a house on fire, 3-0. Limped through the last 3 games at 0-3, but it did not stop Tyreek Hill and Jaylen Waddle from combining to go for more than 300 yards, albeit in a losing effort last Sunday against the Minnesota Vikings.
So, obviously, Tua's had this one circled, and he's probably going to say all the right things. I think he's hinted at some underlying issues there, but if you follow the paper trail, he knows that Brian Flores didn't want him to be the quarterback, and that's why he was constantly being tested for PEDs during his last season. I think what's interesting here, and we kind of talked off air, we're still trying to figure this game out, so I'm going to be a little bit more discreet in what I attempt to divulge here. But what's interesting with this Miami Dolphins offense is that they have the fifth best passing offense without a starting quarterback the last 3 weeks. And that's going against
how a top dare five you talk about Teddy Bridgewater like that? How well, dare you?
Skyler too. You forgot about Skyler getting some snaps.
Everybody there, so. Forgot about Skyler.
So you're still looking at an offense that's top five, again, despite not having its starting quarterbacks, while also going up against the top five schedule of defenses. So you have to make a manual adjustment in this game for the return of Tua. And I think ultimately the Steelers are being credited for a win last week. And Grant, when you win outright as a dog that reached the double-digit threshold a couple times last week, kudos to you. I think Mike McDaniel is going to be far smarter than Byron Leftwich. And this is one thing that we've talked about on this show ad nauseum, right? Like all of the Byron Leftwich needs a job without the idea of like Tom Brady assisting things, right? All of the Eric Bieniemy needs a job without the knowledge of like Andy Reid and Patrick Mahomes assisting things. I think we're quickly seeing those guys are not as good as perceived. And so what we saw last week from Byron Leftwich was a guy that just continued to run on first down and early downs and throw short rather than push the ball downfield with four defensive starters in the secondary out for Pittsburgh. And if you look on 54 early downs last week, Leftwich called 22 runs, yet passing yielded an 18% increase in success rate. 16 first down runs for Leftwich on 30 first downs. They churned out a negative 0.13 EPA per rush. Coming into that game, the Buccaneers were 30th in schedule-adjusted rush efficiency, but they were top 10 through the air, and that was with a receiver core mostly decimated by both injury and suspension in the five prior samples. So that will leave you scratching your head on what Byron Leftwich attempted to implement last week. And you can say, oh, Pittsburgh was getting big pressure on Brady. Then you go and actually look at the numbers. It was well below league average. The one thing with this game is the Steelers secondary should be healthier. You saw guys like, you know, Cam Sutton, Levy Wallace, Akilah Weatherspoon, Minkah Fitzpatrick. Those guys have practiced to this point in the week. So that bodes well for the Steelers defense getting some of those guys healthy in the secondary. And to your point, they'll need it when you're dealing with guys like Waddle and Hill here.
Yeah, definitely a little bit more big play potential. One other thing when you look at the Steelers offense too, and we can hit on that side of the ball pretty quickly.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't want to call it smoke and mirrors, but when you dig into some of the numbers, the Steelers were 4-for-4 last week on 3rd and 11 or longer in the second half alone. The rest of the National Football League paint in those situations, 4-of-29. Little to say, that's not exactly sustainable and a recipe for success, but to your point, you're a double-digit dog. You do what you can to fight, grab and claw your way to an outright victory. But let's not sugarcoat what this Steelers offense isn't. And right now, it's far from a well-oiled machine. We continue to wait and see if Kenny Pickett will be the starter. Some interesting speculation about how he has a concussion and is ruled out on Sunday, yet can return as a full participant or at least listed as such on Wednesday. And Mike Tomlin wasn't shy about it, said if Kenny Pickett clears concussion protocol, he will be our starting quarterback on Sunday Night Football against the Dolphins.
Yep.
But this is a Steelers team that seems to be a one-trick pony, and you called it early on. I mean, we gave it out as one of our better season-long prop bets. Najee Harris can't do it by himself, and he's been completely bottled up. So it's boom or bust for the Steelers when it comes to their passing attack against the Dolphins' defense.
That's what makes this game a little interesting, and we're kind of just lying in the weeds waiting around because you have some of the more well-respected minds covering fantasy and betting that were former doctors, and they're scratching their head saying, how is this possible that he's a full participant in practice under these guidelines? So it's shocking. And when I say he, Kenny Pickett, obviously, how is he practicing in full to this point? So it would lead you to believe there's some potential there, but who knows? Does the league step in and say, hey, we don't want any shenanigans in a standalone game and front of a national audience? Like, I don't know what's going to transpire there, but what's really interesting to me is you mentioned the Steelers' inability to run the ball. It's very simple. They are horrific running the ball, and the Dolphins are 7th best in schedule-adjusted defensive rush efficiency. So in my mind, this game would set up to be a pass funnel. Now, I don't know if that's the approach Pittsburgh would feel comfortable using if it's Mitch, probably a little more comfortable if it's Pickett. And then you think about not just that matchup within the trenches, but Dolphins secondary. Byron Jones is still on PUP and out. Nick Needham is now out for the season. Crossan didn't play in week six, hasn't practiced yet this week. And the one thing that you will look at and see here, Pittsburgh has the weapons outside to win one-on-one, clearly, if it's just Xavien Howard out there. And Pittsburgh's faced the second toughest schedule of pass defenses in the league. So this is going to be a big step down with 31st Miami and the injuries that they have in that secondary. So this would set up, at least from a normal game plan perspective, with Kenny Pickett out there, that you're going to want to chuck the ball, get it out of his hands quick, avoid some of the blitzes and the pressures that Miami likes to send, and let your receivers just feast here. But you look at who the coach is, and if it's Mitch Trubisky, you don't know if that's actually going to be implemented.
This is vintage that, road Mike Tomlin.
That's what makes this handicap a little different. Yeah.
This is vintage road Mike Tomlin territory. Run the ball three times and punt the football on fourth and two and hope you can play field position thinking that you have a steel curtain defense of the 1970s compared to the current iteration that leaves a lot to be desired, especially without TJ Watt in the mix.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, right, like, not to completely tip the hand here, but if you get Kenny Pickett up and we catch a little better wind of what Pittsburgh's going to implement on offense and you get a 44 here, you know, I'm intrigued by some points being scored. And we'll just kind of leave it at that, and we'll see how it shakes out.
Should be a hell of a game to see Miami's Dolphins offense on full display with Tua back under center. Obviously, a lot more dynamic. No disrespect meant to Skylar Thompson or Teddy Bridgewater, but you look at the numbers that Tua has put forth in a limited sample size this season, actually leads the National Football League in passer rating, producing at a higher clip than both the likes of Josh Allen and Patrick Mahomes. Again, you can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there as well. Most importantly, follow the podcast at BetTheBoardPod. And Payne, best bet time. I know the listeners missed the sound of our voices last week to try and guide them to the window during NFL Week 6. As far as an actionable opportunity this week, where are you taking the listenership?
We talked a little bit about this off air, and the only thing that we've bet to this point are the Indianapolis Colts, rotation number 455. And I think ultimately what you're going to see here is Jonathan Taylor get upgraded, Nyheim Hines get upgraded, Shaq Leonard upgraded, and it's going to send this line in one direction. And you have the quick revenge angle here, which, you know, kind of is what it is. But on the field, the first time these teams played, the Colts showed well the back half of that game. And there's certainly some matchups here that would dictate them having some advantages. What I will say is you're looking right now at a spread that's 2.5 across the board. The Titans, in some places, 2.5 minus 15. So that side's juiced a little bit. I would encourage the buy. 3 minus 20 is widely available. Still some 3 minus 25 out there. And I understand, you know, there's some guys that, based upon some of these results this season, are valuing the numbers like 3 and 7 a little bit differently. But what I can tell you is the data that we have is absolutely primo. And in a game with the total at 42, you can actually still see value in the buy 2-3 up until minus 132. So would encourage you to buy 2-3 on the Colts at anything better than that price, and that'll be the best bet this week.
Hey, I mean, it's all about the numbers. That's the name of the game. I know there are a lot of folks out there that are detractors when it comes to buying points, but you cannot run the math. And when it comes to identifying an edge, you do the things that give you the best opportunity to cash tickets week in, week out in the National Football League or other gambling pursuits. Indianapolis Colts, plus the field goal on the bye, the best bet for this week. And we'll hope that Matt Ryan continues his renaissance as people wanted to take him out behind the barn and shoot him like old Yeller when he looked like an old man the first couple of games of the season.
One thing I want to ask you, by the way.
Sure,
and I
fire
know
away.
We only broke down four games, but it's an interesting conversation because we talked about it a little bit off air and through text message. What do you make of this Texans-Raiders game?
I think it's an interesting game for a number of reasons. When you look at the Houston Texans, they haven't exactly been stout stopping the run, so that's obviously a major cause for concern, and we saw Josh Jacobs get going in two games, more an accumulator of stats than anything you would define as overly efficient. Meanwhile, this is a Raiders team. I mean, the numbers don't lie. They're not the kind of franchise over the last couple of years, especially with Derek Carr under center, that runs away and hides from their opponents. They've struggled immensely, especially as favorites of more than a field goal. You look at some of the matchups for the Houston Texans, and that secondary is actually performing better than I anticipated coming into the year. I think for football nerds out there, watching Derek Stingley potentially match up with Devontae Adams is a very fascinating dynamic, because the Carr to Adams connection hasn't been what we thought it was going to be. Yes, the big plays have been there, but when you talk about receptions as a percentage of target share, far and away has underwhelmed. Hunter Renfrow hasn't been nearly as big a piece of the offense as he was for stretches last year. I don't know what the hell is going on with Darren Waller, but with this number hovering around a touchdown, look, I don't love the Texans on the road more than anybody, but I think it's a fascinating game because Houston has shown an ability to run even behind a beleaguered offensive line.
Waller still has not practiced yet this week. So I came in initially saying to myself, I'm going to be really intrigued by the Texans. And obviously there's a group that nibbled a little bit at Chris yesterday.
Yeah, seeing the 6.5 there now.
Then I dug into this just a little bit. And the weirdness of this season, and at some point here we'll divulge what that is. It is all about scheme here for me with this one, because the Raiders defensively has done a better job stopping the run than the pass. And you kind of indicated that, you know, some of the run metrics for Houston are a little bit phony, right? Damian Pierce is just an absolute monster right now. He has been fantastic breaking tackles. You're looking at an offensive line that's not creating a bunch of push. They're bottom five in yards allowed before first contact. So it's very much the Damian Pierce show. And so then all of a sudden, if you're not running the ball here, it's just on Davis Mills. The interesting part of this game and why this season's been difficult, we've talked about too high shell a little bit and the usage of it. It's oddly not as much of an increase as people have been led to believe, right? First three quarters on early downs year over year, it's actually only like a 2% uptick in usage of too high shell. And the Houston Texans had been a team that were running too high shell at a below average league rate. And then all of a sudden, against Trevor Lawrence, pre-bye, spiked it up to more than 85%, which was the highest rate used in more than 2 years. And so if Houston is going to come out with that same game plan, they become intriguing because Derek Carr has not shown well against that type of coverage. I just don't know if they're going to come out in that coverage. And so it really becomes about X's and O's and scheme there. And I was just having trouble assessing that game and wanted to hear your opinion on it.
Well, knowing that we only broke down four games, curious to get your take from a football fan standpoint or teams that you're curious about. Is there a game you're looking forward to watching that we haven't covered? Not necessarily from a gambling perspective, but that you're fascinated to see unfold?
I would say Cleveland and Baltimore simply because I didn't understand the move downward on Cleveland from 7 down to 6. And it seems like someone smart woke up and late last night laid the 6 on the Ravens. I didn't understand that initial move. And, you know, there's a little bit of a battle going on with that total. So just from that perspective, I'm intrigued to watch that game.
Yeah, it makes a ton of sense. I guess if I'm thinking about it that way, I have a weird, morbid curiosity with Denver Broncos football so far this season, given how many times we've seen them in primetime. Let's see how the Jets handle a little bit of prosperity and expectations. I know some prominent NFL journalists have said this team has a significantly higher ceiling. I'll ask the question, have they watched the Jets operate offensively? It's Breece Hall and basically not much else. But hey, full credit to Robert Saleh and what this team is doing in a rebuild. They just have to figure out if they have the quarterback that can get them where they want to go and compete with the Buffalo Bills atop the AFC East.
No doubt Joe Douglas has added some talent there.
The roster's been upgraded. It's been upgraded a ton. I mean, we said that in the wake of the draft. It's hard, you know, as terrible as it is to say, to swing and miss with multiple first-round picks. But Sauce Gardner has been a slam dunk thus far and is only going to get better. Breece Hall has been outstanding in the backfield. And when you look elsewhere on the roster, they check a number of boxes. So for the first time in a while, Jets fans have something to be optimistic about going forward. But I just don't want to see them get set up for failure, thinking some of what they've seen the first six games will be indicative of how this team will perform over the next 11. As always, I want to thank all of you, our loyal listeners, for tuning into the show. Again, we do all of this for you guys, and I know you missed us last week. We miss being here for you as well. So hopefully you've been able to take a couple of nuggets from our four deep dives this weekend, turn them into actionable components, and make it one of your more successful betting weekends of the season. For Payne Insider, I'm Todd Furman, wishing you the best of luck for NFL Week 7. And with an Indianapolis Colts ticket in hand come Sunday afternoon, we'll see you at the window.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.